He hadn't come out for our touch football game. He was a tree with a limb ripped off, the pulp a harsh, raw white. No one ever mentioned the yellow man to him, or to the runt. But if the runt was infected, at least he'd have done some snazzy, dirty things with Angel before he died. I asked Potts how he was.
I don't know.
Okay, I guess. Otis loves the fall, the leaves. I keep thinking I'm not doing a good job here, you know?
You're all doing a good job, said the Lego, standing before us. But you as a group have not been getting enough post-mortem permissions. It's hard to describe the importance of the autopsy. By the autopsy is the heart, no, the flower, the red rose of medicine. Yes, the great Firko, the father of pathology, performed 25,000 autopsies with his own two hands. It's crucial to our understanding of disease. For instance, that Czech, nicknamed, what was he called, Dr. Fishberg?
Not was called, sir, is called. The Yellow Man, sir.
Yes, take the Yellow Man.
The Lego went on to take the Yellow Man, stressing how important it would be for us to get the post when he died. And as he spoke, each word seemed to rip into poor, quiet Potts.
When I was an intern, said the Lego cheerily, we got 75% post permissions. Of course, in those days we did the autopsies ourselves. But you know something? We didn't mind, because we were helping to advance the science of medicine.
The Lego said that the Terns were not getting enough post-mortem permissions, and since he knew how hard it is to approach the family for permission in their hour of need, he thought of a way to raise the incentive.
An award. The award will go to the intern with the most post-mortem permissions for the year. The prize will be a free trip for two to Atlantic City for the AMA in June with Dr. Fishberg and myself.
There was dead silence. No one knew what to say, until Howie, puffing and smiling, said, "Damn good idea, Chief, but maybe it should be a trip to the American Pathological instead." "I don't think it should be the most posts," I said, sure that the Lego was joking. "I mean, after all, wouldn't that put a premium on death? The turn with the most deaths would probably win, and that would make us lay off treatment. Or even worse, kill off patients to win the prize."
"Yeah," said Eddie. "Why not make it a percentage of deaths?"
The Lego and the fish didn't laugh. And as the meeting broke up, no one was sure whether they'd been serious or not. "Of course they're serious," said Hyper Hooper, "and I'm going to win it. The Black Crow. Atlantic City, here I come. Saltwater taffy, strolling along the boardwalk." He grinned and started to sing to us. "Under the boardwalk, down by the sea." And so, if they were serious, the Black Crow Award came into being, at least as much being as the MVI. Hyper Hooper, the turn who got off on death, really got off. And we others who still didn't like death and were repulsed even more by autopsies felt that once again the odds were getting stacked against the living, and that we had to work even harder to protect the poor unsuspecting patients who came, trusting, into the house of God, oblivious to that incentive for their deaths and posts, the Black Crow. Hooper didn't waste any time, for the next afternoon, as I was dictating a discharge summary, from the next cubicle I heard his familiar voice. "The patient was admitted in good health except for a urinary tract infection." I went on dictating, but tuned back in a few seconds later. "The temperature rose to 107, and a resistant strain of Pseudonymus grew out of the spinal fluid culture."
"Spinal fluid? I thought it had started in the urinary tract."
"The intern was called to see the patient and found her unresponsive. She expired 3 hours later. Permission for the postmortem was obtained."
"Yahoo!
This is H. Hooper, M.D.
As he was rushing out, I caught his arm and asked him what had happened, and he said,
"The usual. Death City. And I got the post. Atlantic City, here I come. Black Crow, black pants and all."
"But she came in healthy."
"Yeah, and then she boxed, and I get credit for the post."
"The Black Crow's gotta go. So long."
"That award's a joke. They couldn't mean it."
"It's no joke. Autopsies are the flower.
No, the red rose of medicine. The Lego wants more posts, so he looks good.
To whom?
Who cares? With that awful birthmark, he'll try any cosmetic procedure. Hey, I gotta go. The little woman and I are going to the eucalyptus room again tonight, trying to float the M off the R.
Ciao!
And so the intern, first out of the starting blocks for the Black Crow Award, sped off down the hallway, out of the house of God, with that same glitter in his eye that the fat man had had over his food and his invention, and that Chuck and I had seen in the runt's eye when he talked pornographically about thunder thighs, and the same glitter that Chuck had had when he'd made mincemeat of Ernie on the court or talked about Hazel, and the same glitter that I had whenever I thought of Molly. Whenever I thought of Molly, I thought of her bendovers and her lacy underwear and the tears that she'd shed when she knew she was going to die when she pulled down her panties to show me the mole on her thigh. Whenever I thought of Molly, something rolled over in my pants and I felt younger than I was and I got a glitter in my eye and I thought about my first love and that bittersweet chaos of fumbling with hooks and belts and zippers and parents on couches, on front seats, on back seats, on movie seats, on rocks and everywhere except in beds. I imagined Molly as young and innocent and fun. Young and innocent? How could I have known that the preceding figment had been brought to me through the courtesy of my imagination? Feeling guilty about trying to seduce this young and innocent fun, I tried my hardest to seduce her. In the house, I would touch her when we worked together, putting a hand on her shoulder, on her hip. She would brush my arm with her breast. She would leave her dress unbuttoned. And in addition to the bendover, she showed more of her repertoire, including what Fats had called the flash sit-down, where in the instant between the sit-down and the leg cross, there's a flash of the fantasy triangle, the French panty bulging out over the downy mons like a spinnaker before the soft, blonde, and hairy trade winds. Even though medically I knew all about these organs and had my hands in diseased ones all the time, still, knowing, I wanted it. And since it was imagined and healthy and young and fresh and blonde and downy soft and pungent, I wanted it all the more. So finally she asked me to go out with her and some other nurses. And we went to this bar where the rock music blasts off only the ossicles of those like me over 30 and leaves unshaken the under 30 who want the volume turned up. And then she taught me to do a dance I'd never heard of, to music I'd never heard of. And then we went back to her apartment she shared with a toothpick of a nurse named Nancy, and Molly asked me if I'd ever seen her place before, and I lied and said no, and she started to show me. And we wandered in on Nancy undressing, and Molly said I was showing him the place, and Nancy, remembering that I'd been there before, said, "He's seen the place before." And Molly looked me in the eye, and I gulped and said, "Yep, I've seen the place before," and she said, "Well, let me show you my bedroom." Delight, delight. She showed me her bedroom with her little girl trinkets, furry toys, and an alive furry kitten, and Halloween masks and temple bells from the Far East, and a makeup kit with backstage-type light bulbs, and the usual prints and strewn pantyhose and bras. And then, in a fit of romance, I feared I was too old for her. We embrace, and I fumble with her bra hooks, and then I get caught up in things so I don't notice what I'm fumbling, and after a little bit of protest from her with my mouth all over her long nipples and my hand on her own furry thing, we are kind of wrestling. She gets on top of me. In the middle of a no, she says, "Oops," and in I slip. And she shows me her secret, which is that she fucks not like a young, innocent little girl, but like a moaning Byzantine courtesan, all gold and warm oil and myrrh. "Now you know my weakness," Molly said the next day in the middle of the nursing station, holding a fleet enema in her hand like a pistol. "What is it?" I asked. "I'm very physical." "How is that a weakness?" "It just is."
"Not if you can handle it."
"What do you mean, handle a weakness?"
"You wouldn't call it a weakness in me, would you?" I asked.
"That's different. You're a man."
You're not going all sexist on me, are you?
No.
Then it's not a weakness in you any more than it is in me. You're just going to have to learn how to handle it.
Yeah, she said in a way that confused me, since I couldn't tell if she were concerned or not. I guess I just will.
Only later, when it became obvious that both of us loved the sex, and in a loose way, each other as much as we did, when the moaning Mons had moved out of the little girl bedroom into the on-call bunk bed whenever I could get rid of the bruiser, and then moved into the ward bathroom for a 5-minute one sitting on the can, and even late one night, crooned to by the Gomer band of renown, moved to a darkened corner of the ward, standing up with our orgasms racing against the appearance of the patrolling night supervisor. Only then did Molly, who called the feeling of making love the feeling of having a centipede walk through wearing gold cleats, only then did she tell me that she didn't give a damn about my having another woman, a steady woman, that she had been hurt by involvement, and hurt by the nuns with their spiritual whips, and that what she was into was freedom in relationships. Which I thought was terrific and too good to be true, until I wondered whether someone else with the old gold cleats was hearing those chuckles and moans and glittering rainbows of orgasms when I was with my long love, Barry. Barry must have suspected something was up. She'd remarked on my changed mood, on how suspicious I'd become of her, accusing her of going to bed with other men when I was on call in the house. She must have known that my jealousy came from my guilt, my fury from my jealousy of who was with her or with Molly when I was not. Things became strained, although at first the least strain was the emotional one. I was having a fantastic time, making love to two women on the same day, enjoying the way that I could separate which aching muscle group went with which woman's moves. The real strain was how to hide Molly from Barry. What contortions I went through, as Molly began to come to my place, to hide her traces. Her hair on the pillow, her spore on the sheets, her hairpin on the bureau, her earring left on the bathroom shelf, her perfume in the air. I began to spend all my time doing laundry. I dreaded the ringing of my phone. Yet I couldn't tell Barry. I cared too much. I was too ashamed. I had too much to lose. Barry and I had thought that we might try living together. But when we found out that my being on call turned me into a snarling bear, we'd decided that it was not a good idea. We'd also decided that we'd not see each other the night after my night on call, because all we did was bicker and bitch. That left only one night in three, the night I was supposedly not exhausted. With our contact decreased, with Molly zinging through my rectus abdominis and ball-tingling cremaster muscle groups, with Barry the clinical psychologist off into mind and with me off into body, we began to drift apart. I began to think her cat hated me. We tried hard to enjoy the fall. We went to a football game, but instead of the bright cheeriness I remembered from going to football games in college, the day turned cold and wet and somber, filling us both with the dread of winter. Exhausted, more or less in silence, skin catching on the rough edges of our love, we dragged back to my apartment, and Barry, feeling woozy with the flu, curled up in my bed with her cat. A safe, warm, fetal ball, she slept. Her cat, eyes closed to me, purred. She snored. I felt so much in love with her, with protecting her from the flu and the world, and my fury and guilt, that I was filled with joy. But as my joy for what had been and could be showed itself, my sadness for what had happened to us crushed it. What a terrific turd I was. She awoke. We talked. We talked about the Gomers, and about how furious Joe and the fish and the Lego were making me, and about how Barry couldn't possibly understand. "You know what your problem is?" she asked. "What?" "You've got no role models. You can't look up to any of them."
"What about the fat man?"
"He's sick." "He's not," I said, starting to get angry. "Besides, there's Chuck and the Runt and Hooper and Eat My Dust and Potts."
Oh, sure, there's the camaraderie, and you're right. The only reason men go to war is to die with their buddies, but it seems to me that what's happening to you is the total institutionalization of the internship, a la Goffman.
What did you say? I asked as evenly as possible, swallowing my rage at her high-ass theory of my pain.
She started to repeat it, and seeing that the words weren't registering, said, Never mind.
Why never mind?
Because you could care less.
Damn it, Roy, you've gotten so concrete. You won't talk about anything except the internship.
Feeling swamped with words, I found myself shouting like Sewerman Ed Norton on TV.
God damn it, I don't want to think, because when I do, I think of the disgusting things I do every day, and it's so awful I want to kill myself. Get it?
You imagine that talking about your feelings would destroy you?
Yeah.
That's a fantasy.
A what?
A fantasy. Why don't you get some help?
Help?
Therapy. We fought. She probably knew we were fighting about Dr. Sanders's long dying, and about the illusion in my father's letters, and about my plethora of absent role models, and the blossoming idea that the Gomers were not our patients but our adversaries. And most of all, we were fighting over the guilt that I felt for having Molly in a dark corner of the ward standing up. This Molly, who, like me, wouldn't stop and think and feel either, because if she ruminated on what she felt about enemas and emesis basins, she'd lose faith even in her centipede and want to kill herself, too. Our fight was not the violent, howling, barking fight that keeps alive vestiges of love, but that tired, distant, silent fight where the fighters are afraid to punch for fear the punch will kill. So this is it, I thought dully. 4 months into the internship, and I've become an animal, a moss-brained moose who did not and could not and would not think and talk. And it's come like an exhausted, cancerous animal to my always love, my buddy Barry and me. Yes, it's come to us. Relationship on rocks. R.O.R.
Chapter 9. Fats? I blurted out in amazement.
The Today Show, said the runt, eyes popping.
The Today Show, I yelled.
Fats, said the runt.
My mind did a swan dive.
But did you actually see him on the Today Show? I asked.
Nope, said the runt, but somebody said they saw him disguised as Dr. Jung, and Barbara Walters was interviewing him about some crazy thing called...
The anal mirror, I know all about it.
They say Barbara was giggling all the time.
Hey, Roy, you want to hear what she does with her mouth?
Barbara Walters?
No, Angel. See, she takes her lips and wraps them around my...
Later, I said. First I want to find Fats. I knew I'd find him eating, for it was lunchtime, and although he'd been farmed out to the Mount St. Elsewhere, he'd made some special deal, as he always made some special deal, with Gracie from Dietarian Food, which allowed him to eat in the House of God for free. With my stomach flip-flopping, I sat down with this gargantua of medicine.
What a delicious rumor, said Fats, laughing. I wish it was true. Sometimes I daydream about a spot interview with Cronkite on the CBS Nightly News.
Why Cronkite? I asked, reeling from the bizarreness of fatherly Walter Cronkite springing Dr. Jung's anal mirror on millions of great Americans expecting only war and jowly Nixon. Supposedly he has an anal fissure. Much of the disease in the world is reflected in the anus, you know, and I keep thinking that somehow, packaged right, the reflection of the diseased anus could make me rich. Just think, if there was an anal mirror, and if Nixon owned one, every day he'd get a good look at exactly what he was. It's just the money, you know? I just want to be rich before socialized medicine kills me off. It's like what Isaac Singer said.
Singer, the writer.
No, Singer the sewing machine. He said, I don't give a damn for the invention. It's the dimes I'm after. But listen, Bash, that Laetrile idea the other night was dynamite. There's money there.
Laetrile?
It's a hoax, worthless, a placebo.
So what's wrong with placebos? Don't you know about the placebo effect?
Of course I do.
Well, there you are. Placebos can relieve the pain of angina. If you're cooling from cancer, placebos are hot stuff. Like dyspareunia.
How? I asked, my mind spinning around the simile.
You know what they say. It is better to have dyspareuned than never to have pareuned at all.
You're crazy. Imagine, we get the Laetril from apricot pits from Mexico by bartering the anal mirrors for apricots.
You try to sell Dr. Jung's anal mirror to the Mexicans?
Of course not Dr. Jung's. Dr. Cortez's anal mirror. A lot of diarrhea in Mexico.
You know how a Mexican knows he's hungry?
How?
His asshole stops burning.
Ah! But we'd have to be careful in Mexico. Might get sued for malpractice.
Why is that?
Well, even though we translate the warning into Spanish, there's always the danger that some jerk would use the anal mirror outdoors on a bright, sunny day. And you know what happens then?
Nope.
Well, the lens concentrates the sunlight, and it bounces back through the two mirrors, and whoosh, you get one flaming asshole, I'll tell you. Suit City. Demand their money back, and all the rest.
And where would the money for all this come from?
From the raffle and the research project.
What raffle and what research project?
Well, at the Mount St. E., I'm thinking of running a raffle, like they did in a Vegas hospital. If you're scheduled to get surgery on Monday, and if you come in on Friday instead of Sunday night, you get free tickets to a raffle for a cruise. That way the Mount St. E. fills its beds, then I get a cut. If you win the raffle but die in surgery, the cruise goes to your estate.
And what about the research project?
I'd rather not say. It would come out of your tax dollar, and it's completely illegal.
How's that?
My next rotation is the VA hospital. Everybody knows how crooked the old VA is, huh? Big-time Watergate-style graft. Graft City.
This is all fantasy, right? I asked, thinking of what Barry might say. To feed your idling mind?
I mean, you wouldn't do any of this, would you, Fats?
After a pause that sent a shiver through me, he said,
"Money is not shit. It is nothing to be ashamed of. This great country has a long and glorious history of graft and corruption and exploitation. Just think of what we've done to whole continents and entire little countries chock full of underdeveloped little people that we've treated like rodents, let alone what we do to individuals. Why should I, or we, hold back? Did that anti-Semite Henry Ford hold back? Did Spiro Agnew? Did Joe McCarthy? Or Joe DiMaggio? You know, the Yankee Clipper is hawking instant coffee on TV these days. Or Marilyn Monroe hold back from letting any subway great in the world blow up her flimsy dress and whistle around her frigid genitalia? Did Norman Mailer ever on anything? Did the CIA or the FB fucking I? The hell they did, Bash. The hell they did. You just gotta do it, flush it, and pick up the money you get for it.
For fraud.
For dreaming the American dream. In this case, the American medical dream.
The runt and Chuck sat down with us. And the runt, like a TV serial that you couldn't turn off, rolled out the latest thrilling episode of Thunder Thighs. She was her usual voracious self. We were watching TV. She rubbed the inside of my thigh. The news finished. She took off all her clothes. She walked into the bedroom. She didn't want to mess around with a lot of foreplay. And the first time, she said something. It got me so turned on, I was short-circuiting left and right.
Well, man, what'd she say?
I'm not sure, but I know it had the word cunt in it. She's a gold mine. I've been poring over her body quite a bit, and it was getting to the point where she was going to have to do some poring over mine. I'd been nibbling at her labia. They're fine and thin, like a puppy dog's ears. And since I've had this fantasy that she was knocked up in high school and had a kid, I was trying to get in there to have a good look for an episiotomy scar. But I got too close, and my eyeballs got all steamed up.
Ha!
We were really building up to something big. We were in this crazy contortion, sort of the reverse dog, with her sort of sitting on my face like my old roommate Norman's women used to do to him, and she was bending over, fiddling with my cock. and then I did it. I sort of gave her one big slurp and gently nudged her head down between my legs, and I'm telling you, she went...
We all stopped chewing.
Bananas!
Bananas? Asked Fats, jaw slack.
Very bananas, said the runt. Ha! It was animal. We were all over the bed. She was moving around on my face, and I could feel her teeth and the base of my dork. Wow, those girls my mom liked, they'd scream whenever my pants would get lumpy at the sock hop. And do you know what she said this time, when I was inside her?
We did not know what Angel had said with the runt's penis inside her.
She said, Oh, Dr. Runtsky, you're so big.
And the runt did look kind of big, sitting there before our eyes. This morning she handed me a toothbrush, and when I went to the bathroom, mine was the third toothbrush in the rack. The fat man had stopped eating about the time that Thunder Thighs had put her lips on the runt's penis, and staring at him as if he were loony, Fat said, What the hell's been going on with you guys up there anyway? So we told him. We told him about Chuck and Hazel, and about me and Molly, and about how the runt, with the help of Towel and Thunder, was getting bigger. We told him about the Golden Age, where we were legendary in our ability to care for the toughies, and legendary in our liaisons, which, because of Hazel, had produced clean sheets and bug-free bedding, and because of Molly, had produced snappy, instant nursing care. We told him how we were as high as the golden leaves riding the crests of the October maples, falling through the gestating skeleton of the wing of Zoc. There's only one thing missing, I said. Placement. We still can't get the Gomers placed. Anna and Ina are still there.
No problem, said Fats. Placement is as easy as pie. Who's responsible for placing the Gomers?
The social service.
Yep, the sociable cervix.
The third toothbrush means that Angel doesn't mind sharing. So why should you?
You guys gotta scrog the sociable cervix, and remember, if you want to scrog the librarian, you gotta talk about Shakespeare.
So long, and good luck.
Well, of course, it was brilliance. Each ward had a sociable cervix, whose responsibility it was to get the Gomers placed. It was an impossible job. No one wanted the poor Gomers. The nursing homes would say the Gomer was too well and didn't need them, and the families would say that the Gomer was too sick and needed a nursing home, and the house privates would say the Gomer was way too sick and needed the House of God Blue Cross care, and the Terns would say we couldn't stand having broccoli ladies who blasted us for keeping them alive, and would the cervix kindly get them the hell out? The Gomers offered no opinion. The cervix was the pimp. It was made up of two types of women. The first was young and energetic and idealistic, working out the guilt of separating from her parents and abandoning her grandparents, all the time jockeying for Mr. Wright, who had to have a stethoscope in his pocket. The second was menopausal, divorced, abandoned by kids like the first, not energetic, but empathic and tearful, cynical and masochistic, working out the upcoming old age and all the time searching for a second or third Mr. Wright, who had to have something non-stethoscopic in his pants. The younger cervix for us was Rosalie Cohen, a young woman who had that pizza-faced look of severe adolescent acne, the kind that never responded to anything. She had the habit of opening her blouse down past Thursday as a decoy from her pitted face. The older, or head cervix, was Selma, whose nose was big and bent. Billing and cooing with Selma would be more bill than coo, perhaps earning the Tern a punctured eyeball. And yet from the neck down, Selma was good. Struggling against the life force as it swept by her, Selma was sexy, and suffused with the form frust of the more liberated than my children syndrome that was ravaging America in the 70s. Producing the pot-smoking mama, and the daughter wailing, Pass me the joint, mother, please. Selma fell right into my lap. I attended that grand rounds where you made those points about keeping the patients in the house too long, Dr. Bash, and I want to tell you, the way you handled the flack was terrific. Chuck looked at me,
and then at the runt, who looked at him, and then at me, and I looked at Chuck, and then back at Selma, who went on, "For 30 years I've been trying to learn to express my anger like that, and you've already got it. I wish you could show me how. And let me tell you, a lot of psychotherapists, the best in town, have tried and failed." Smiling seductively, heart sinking, I knew that I was the one. The next morning, Chuck was the first to arrive at Joe's rounds, a half hour late. An hour later, I straggled in, and sometime later, in rolled the runt. When we had shaken off the foaming Joe, I told Chuck and the runt how I'd gone over to Selma's that night, how we'd started listening to hard rock, how Selma had started to talk about her loneliness and her burdenous nose, and how, after a drink and a joint, Selma had told me she wanted me to stay. Cringing at the way she reminded me of my mom, I'd thought of my obligation to my buddies and prepared for the worst. And when Selma rheostatted down the lights and took off her bra, I was shocked. Bad, huh? Man, we'll never get these gomers placed. Nope, not bad. Good. Great. Her breasts are beautiful. Vintage Ava Gardner, made in 1916 and still dynamite. Well, man, how does she do it? I asked her. Premarin. Premarin? Premarin. Premarin. Estrogen supplements. Total body female hormone. It's like making love to purified molecular woman. Stupendous. During all this, the runt had been silent. But as I finished, he burst out with his story, which was that he'd spent the night with Rosalie Cohen, which prompted Chuck to grimace and say, "You did it with that ugly bugly? Yuck." "It was great," said the runt, beaming his maniac smile. "The man who scrogged Rosalie Cohen," I said. "Chuck, we have created a monster." "Man, what was it like to wake up to old Rosalie?" "Well," said the runt, "I did try hard not to look on her face." The gomers began to get placed. The true golden age had arrived. From the Lego to the bruiser, no one in the hierarchy could understand how the nursing home beds seemed to open at a touch for Ward 6 South, and only for Ward 6 South. Gomers as close to legal death as possible were described by our cervix as being of excellent rehabilitation potential, and were admitted to the homes the day the beds fell free. Incontinent gomers who were shitting all over the ward were described as continent of feces and urine, and shitting on the ambulance stretcher, and shitting on the down elevator, and shitting in the hallway leading to the ambulance, and shitting through the wailing ambulance ride came to rest to shit their way to immortality in the nursing home of their family's choice. In homes like the New Masada, their bodies stacked floor by floor in order of morbidity, those imagined closest to death put on the topmost floors, imagined closest to heaven. Anna and Ina had been around for 4 months, and so it was sad to see them go. But if they sensed our waving goodbye, they answered only with "Rudel" and "Gaive." Heaving and smelly, the broccoli lady left too. And the exodus went on and on. As the gomers left, the ward filled up with more toughies. And every once in a while, one of these dying young would be saved. One day, in Saul the leukemic tailor's latest bone marrow biopsy, like a rash of crocuses in the charred fields of Hiroshima, normal white cells sprouted. "What?" I said, peering through the microscope at these millions of flowers that meant that Saul might live. "A remission. Look." "Damn, something else," said Chuck, looking.
"Mm-hmm. Now ain't that some fine shit?"
"It's wonderful," I said, realizing how I'd kept myself from hoping anything for Saul, given the odds against these buddings, these buds. And I ran up to his room and, panting, yelled at him, "Saul, you've got a remission."
"Sounds bad," he said. "First leukemia, now remission, oi."
"No, remission means cure, a miracle. You're not going to die."
"I'm not? What do you mean I'm not going to die?"
Not now, you're not, no.
The bruised little man stopped, still. He let go of his banter. He looked me in the eye. He slumped down on his bed.
Oh, I'm not going to die now. I mean, right now?
No, Saul, you're not. You're going to live.
Oh, thank God.
And he grabbed me and put his head on my shoulder, and with all those centuries and years of never daring to hope, he sobbed, and his thin body trembled against me like a child's.
So some more of this wife of mine, huh? Oh, it's good. It's real good. Thank God. Mind you, Dr. Bash, till now, for me, he hasn't done so much, but this is life. This is a new baby, born.
We were so happy. The world was curable and sexual and fun, and we were high. We were red-hots at the bosoms and nipples and bangles and thighs of the house of God. It was as comforting as had been the trucks rumbling down the cobblestone hill in the Bronx, lulling me to sleep as a child when we stayed at my Aunt Lil's. And it was all so easy, and it was all so damn much fun. It wasn't easy, and it was not fun. Our crooked Veep resigned, and honest Jerry Ford started right in bashing those helicopter doors with his head. On the Sunday after Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre, when he tried to stop people trying to get rid of him by getting rid of them, I awoke to a blaring late fall day leaved with all the leafy colors, glad to be alive, until I entered the living death of the House of God for the next 36 hours. Sundays in the house always made me feel like a punished kid, locked inside and looking out. Joe, the outsider, spent her life looking in, and reluctant to entrust her ward to sex fiends and maniacs like us, she'd always come in on her day off, Sunday, to help. Joe had invited me to dinner the previous week. Her apartment was motel cool. The stereo was still not unpacked. There were no plants. The dining room table had had to be cleared of journals and texts. Struggling stiffly through dinner, we sat and talked. I became immersed in her loneliness. When she talked about how hard it was to be a woman in medicine, to meet men outside the field, what could I say? She wanted to try hard to understand us, even be friends with us. She didn't like the tension on the ward. Choosing me because I was the oldest, seemingly the leader, she asked me what I thought was getting in the way. "You've got to trust us more," I said. "Loosen up. It's no crime not to do everything for every patient always, is it?" Nervously, she said, "No, it's not. I know that. But it's hard for me to accept it." "Try. What can I do?" "Well, I guess one thing would be not to come in when I'm on call next Sunday. That would be a good start." "Right. I'll try. Thanks, Roy. Thanks a lot." On that Sunday, Joe was in the House of God earlier than me. Trying to restrain myself, I said, "You had to come in." "I tried not to, Roy. Believe me, I tried. But I'm studying for boards, and I can only study so much. Besides, you might need some help." I realized I was trapped. Enraged, I couldn't tell her, for fear it would send her hurtling down off a bridge. Even with her turns tormenting her with their sexual carnival, each hint of which hurt her, making her feel more and more left out, her only happiness was inside the medical hierarchy inside the house, where she could kill herself by doing super-dedicated medical stunts. The combination of Joe, the bruiser, and my first admission brought me to my knees. The admission? Henry was a 23-year-old with no workable kidneys, who'd been sent from one of the Mount St. Elsewheres after they'd parlayed his renal disease into an infected, dry, dribbling, uremic mass of flesh just this side of the grave. Henry was also retarded. To save Henry, I had to be able to understand the chart sent in from the Mount St. E. It was lightly photocopied, unnumbered, and written by a foreign medical graduate, and I could not read it. The bruiser came in and tried to help by reading some of the chart out loud. I told him that this was not a BMS case and to scram, and leaving, he asked, "What's he got?" "Microdeckia," I said.
"What's that?"
"Look it up." He left, and once again I tried to read the chart, and I could not. I looked out the window at the autumn. A young couple was having a leaf fight, the leaves sticking to their white Irish sweaters. I got tears in my eyes. I was all choked up with what I was missing. The second cup of coffee in bed with the woman and the Sunday Times, the ache in the lungs from the icy morning air. Joe came in and asked me to present the case. I blew. I forgot everything and screamed at her that if she stayed one more minute, I was leaving. I shouted at her, all kinds of dark green things about her, her emotional problems, her hunger to be on the inside. I stood up, towering over her, and I yelled until I was bright blue and tears were on my cheeks, and I didn't stop until I'd chased the little twerp of a victim of success out the door, down the elevator, and out of the house of God. I went back to the notes on Fast Henry. I sat there and cried. It was a balancing act, and I slammed my fist down on the desk over and over, bashing away at the world. I could not go on. I thought what I'd thought as a kid, playing Superman. If I did my best, I couldn't be wrong. I went on. I went to see Fast Henry, a gray young fellow with a retarded look, a voice that leaped from bass to falsetto every other word, and his hair parted down the middle like Wrong Way Corrigan. I asked him how he was doing, and he said, "Doc, if I died tomorrow, I'd be the happiest man alive." And somehow that helped me, and I went to work on him. The other help that miserable day was the bruiser, who single-handedly destroyed Joe's ward. He'd started to work up the second admission, a young woman with black lace undies, suffering from ulcerative colitis. Although the bruiser was excited at the blood and mucus he found on his finger on rectal exam, and was all hot to sigmoidoscope her that day and go to the library to read like crazy about stool, he was embarrassed by the erotic part of the exam. Unfortunately, the patient took a liking to the bruiser and, naked, head to toe, got the message to him that she was turned on, enjoying his exam. When the bruiser got that message, he freaked, ran away, and came to me quivering. "I've never seen a woman naked before, and never a young female patient. They didn't teach us about this. Oh, I'm so ashamed." "Ashamed? What the hell did you do to her?" "Nothing. I'm ashamed of the unprofessional thoughts in my heart." He was so upset that he refused to continue to work her up until he'd talked it over with his analyst. And so I let him continue to work on Mrs. Biles, the woman with the fake heart disease whom he'd bruised earlier in her house stay. At 1 a.m., the bruiser stood before me and said, "Well, I've just finished hypnotizing Mrs. Biles." "You did what to whom?" I asked nonchalantly. "Mrs. Biles. I hypnotized her to take away her cardiac pain." "No fooling. Does Dr. Kreinberg know?" "Nope. Didn't tell him yet." "Hey, I'm sure he'd like to know. Why don't you give him a buzz?" "Now?" asked the bruiser. "It's 1 in the morning. "So?" He likes hearing new developments on his patients. The bruiser called little Otto Kreinberg. "Hello, Dr. Kreinberg. This is Dr. Levy." "Bruce Levy?" "No, you're right. I'm not really a doctor. I'm a BMS, but..." "Right." "Well, I've gotten in the habit of calling myself Dr. Levy." "Oh, yeah, I wanted to tell you. I've just finished hypnotizing Mrs. Biles for her hypnotizing?
H-Y-P-N-O.
"Right, like a magician. And she..." "For her anxiety, and I..."
"Yes?"
"Sure. Oh. Oh. But it's an accepted..." "Okay. Sorry. Yes. I'll awaken her from her trance right away, sir. Goodbye." Looking sheepish, Bruiser started to slink out, and I asked him if he'd do me a favor. "Yeah?" he asked, thinking he might redeem himself.
I've been busy all day, and I haven't had a chance to go to the toilet. Could you go for me? A number two? I've done a number one. You can't treat me like this. Besides, I looked up microdeckia, and there's no such thing.
Microdeckia? Sure.
Not playing with a full deck.
Night.
I went to bed. Molly was night nurse, and all our efforts to get to bed had been frustrated, first by the bruiser, then by the Gomers. But now the bruiser was in the library, and I'd buffed the Gomers for the night, and I sat on the on-call bed, naked, awaiting my nurse. Hazel had buffed the sheets, and next to the House of God pillow was a doll made from rubber tubing and gauze pads, with a note pinned to it. Roy the noisy boy, Molly the jolly girl, am coming in if you're my toy, and not too busy for a whirl. Call me. Finally. In delicious anticipation, I found myself looking out the window at the nursing school dorm. In one of the rooms, a nurse was undressing. She took off her uniform, then made that wonderful motion of hyperextending the elbows around her back to undo her bra. Just as Molly walked in, she let them fly. Fine, fine. I was a time bomb. Molly sat on the bed, and I showed her what I was watching. I unbuttoned her dress and unhooked her bra and caught her little girl breasts by their longing nipples. All over me, her dress was off, her pantyhose were off, her bikinis were off, and she was going off. I thought of the Englishman's idea of perfection. When he, his alarm, and his mistress all go off at the same time. And just before we got that firm, fun thing into her hollow, funnily thing, she stopped, and in between her little gasps of pleasure said, "Did I ever show you what the nuns teach nurses to do when a patient gets an erection?"
"Nope."
"The nuns said to slap it, and it would go down."
"Do you want it to go down?"
"No, I want it to go up me and fuck me." And we started doing that, more and more and more and more, and just as we were about to go off, there was an incredible crash that rocked the bed, and my beeper lady fired again, and she wanted me right away, but Molly wanted me more right away, saying, "Jesus Christ Almighty, I'll finish it off, ah, ah, ah." The crash had come when the bruiser, in trying to make up for all he'd done wrong that day, had decided to help me out by using the turf tool, the electric Gomer bed, to turf Mrs. Biles, the bruised and hypnotized little-autoed Mrs. Biles, elsewhere. He'd chosen the orthopedic height, and it looked from the right-angle bend in Mrs. Biles's left trochanter that he'd broken her hip. "I did it for you, Dr. Bash," said the bruiser proudly, smiling. "I've already paged ortho." "Bruiser, it's hard for me to tell you this. I appreciate what you did, but that Gomer bed thing was a joke."
"A what?"
"A joke. The fat man was joking."
"Oh, God. Oh, my God. I think I've made a terrible mistake. I'd better go and phone Dr. Kreinberg right away."
"Bruiser."
"Yes?"
"Call your analyst first." Many of the dying young died. Jimmy, in the SICU with the balls to ride a Harley guy, was treated with the standard rat bane used to wipe out cancerous bone marrow. And bald and infected and bruised and bleeding, he died. Fast Henry, who in fact also had a cancer, got his wish to be the happiest man alive one tomorrow when he died. And many other young ones died. When I asked Chuck, "Hey, how come the ones our age die?" he said,
"Don't know, but we sure are leading a great life, ain't we?"
Everyone knew that eventually the yellow man would die. And all that time, Dr. Sanders had been dying. Dr. Sanders had been dying a long time. Bald and infected, quiet and cachectic, he was getting his life in order. We were friends. He was dying with a calm strength, as if his dying were part of his life. I was beginning to love him. I began to avoid going into his room.
I understand, he said. It's the hardest thing we ever do, to be a doctor for the dying.
Talking about medicine, I told him with bitterness about my growing cynicism about what I could do, and he said,
No, we don't cure. I never bought that either. I went through the same cynicism, all that training, and then this helplessness. And yet, in spite of all our doubt, we can give something. Not cure, no. What sustains us is when we find a way to be compassionate, to love. And the most loving thing we do is to be with a patient, like you are being with me.
I tried to sit with him. I watched Molly take care to clip his fingernails and toenails so he wouldn't scratch himself and bleed or get infected. I watched everyone keep sterile around his bed. I watched Joe treat him like a case. And I watched his oncologist chatter to him with perfect objectivity about his impending death. And all the time I hoped against hope that when he died, he would die neat. His death was a mess. I was called in the middle of the night and found him, despite massive platelet transfusions that had been dissolved by the cytotoxic rat poison in his system, bleeding out. Barely conscious when I got to him, his blood pressure was almost nothing. He had trickles of geranium red blood dripping from both nostrils and from the corners of his bloated, bruised mouth. And I knew that he was bleeding from every little ruptured capillary in his gut. He was only conscious enough to say, Help me. Please help me. I realized that there was nothing I could do to help him, except what he'd said was the only thing a doctor could do. Be with him. I took his head in my lap and sponged away the blood and looked into his sightless eyes and said, I'm here. And I think he knew that I was. Help me. Help me. More blood trickled out. And I wiped it away and said, I'm here. And I just cried. In silence, so as not to scare him, I wept.
Hi, Roy boy, how's it going anyway?
Howard was in the doorway, filling it with his asinine grin and his pipe smoke, and I hissed at him, Get out of here. Sitting down in the chair across the room, he puffed and said,
Looks bad for Dr. Sanders, doesn't it?
Gosh, it's tough. Get the hell out of here, now.
You don't mind if I watch, do you?
Follow-up, you know. It's tough in the EW because you don't get any follow-up on the patients you admit.
I was like follow-up. Sense of completion, ending.
Learn a lot.
Get out of here, Howard, please. Help me.
The blood ran. My lap was wet with it. The eyes were glazing. I'm here. And I hugged him.
You gonna get the post? Asked Howard.
I wanted to leap up and kill him, but I couldn't, I wouldn't leave Dr. Sanders until he left me. I begged Howard to leave, and he smiled and said how hard it was to have someone dying whom you cared about. And he puffed his pipe and stayed.
Help.
So I tried to obliterate Howard. And as I was wetted with Dr. Sanders's thin blood, I found myself wanting only to be able to kill Dr. Sanders with something painless and neat instead of being with him in my helplessness.
Help me. God, this is off.
I tried to think of good things. Of a woman in a punt on the willowed Cherwell at Oxford, trailing her finger in the leafy stream. But all I could think of was the day's headlines. The 16-year-old girl who'd run away to see the world and who was found off a Florida beach, naked, folded up in a weighted traveling case. And a beaten child wheeled into a courtroom curled up in a fetal position in a crib, who was a vegetable and who was not going to get any better. And the surgeon said that when he'd first gotten to the child, he didn't even know what he was looking at because it was a mass of rotten flesh, days old. And on the abused child's back, burned into his flesh and scabbed over, were the letters I-C-R-Y. when I looked back down into my lap, Dr. Sanders was dead. Much of the 80% blood water that had been him was drained out onto me. I held his head in my lap until his sick, killer blood had oozed out of his heart and brain and into his gut and skin and all the places it never should have been, and refusing to clot had flowed out of all the open holes in his body, the last his laxing anus. I held his hairless head in my lap and in my arms until the flow stopped. I lay him back in his bed and covered him gently with his sheet, and I wept. He was the first patient whom I'd loved who'd died. I went to the nursing station. The way I put my feet down, one in front of the other, made me think of a chronic schizophrenic I'd seen, a former Ziegfeld girl who'd been in an asylum since the Follies, and who each day, rain or shine, would trudge across the meadow with a determined and precise step in an unerring and clean straight line that would have brought joy to a surveyor's heart. Clomp, clomp, clomp. Going nowhere. Empty inside. "Dr. Sanders is dead," I said, sitting down. "That's too bad. Did you get the postmortem?" asked Joe.
"What?"
I said, "Did you get the postmortem?" I had a vision of lifting the little prodigy up by her thin shoulders, shaking her until her brain splattered against her shell of a skull and she convulsed, kneeing her in the guts until I'd wrecked her ovaries from ever spitting out another egg, and then heaving her through the sixth-floor window so she'd splatter and have to be sucked up by noisy, powerful sucking-up machines and become a bag of goo, picked over and strained by Hyper Hooper's Israeli pathology resident in the morgue. But Joe was pitiful, and so I gritted my teeth and just said, "No. Why not?" "I didn't want to." "That's not good enough," said Joe. "I didn't want to see his body ripped to shreds in the morgue. I don't understand what you're saying. I loved him too much to see his body ripped apart downstairs. That kind of talk has no place in modern medicine." "So don't listen," I said, beginning to lose control. "The postmortem is important," said Joe. "It's the flower of the science of medicine. I'll call the next of kin myself." "Don't you dare," I screamed. "I'll kill you if you do." "How do you think we're able to deliver such precise medical care to those entrusted to us?" asked Joe. "That's bullshit that we deliver medical care at all," I said. "Have you gone mad? This ward, my ward, is looked up to in the house for being the most efficient and having the most success with placement and handling the toughies with skill. My ward is a legend." "Damn it," said Joe, jutting her jaw. "I want that post." "Joe, go fuck yourself. I'll have to report this to the Fish and Lego. I won't have sentimentality ruining my ward. My ward has become a legend in its own time." "Do you know why it's become a legend?" "You don't want to hear." "Of course I want to hear, even though I know why already." So I told her. I started by telling her about how Chuck and I had, after our original empirical test on Anna O, become fanatics at doing nothing, and had lied to Joe about it, making up all forms of imaginary tests and buffing the charts. I told her how, in modified form, we'd done the same with the dying young, who went ahead and died, but died without the hassle, pain, and prolongation of suffering that their care might otherwise have produced. The final thing I told her about was placement. "Placement picked up because the social service liked me, and I did such a good job running my ward," said Joe anxiously. "Joe, everybody hates you, and the only reason that placement picked up is that the runt and I are fucking Rosalie Cohen and Selma, respectively, not to mention the clean sheets."
"What about the clean sheets?"
"Chuck has been fucking Hazel from housekeeping."
"I don't believe you. No one would do this to me."
"Everyone would if they could, but your turns are in a privileged position."
"You just think you're above it all," said Joe.
"Better than everyone else, like you don't have to stoop down to get postmortems. You're afraid of the dirty side of medicine, right?"
"No, sir," I said.
You mean you're not afraid of the dirty side of medicine?